Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season, we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week, we've got music from a band that labels themselves not quite folk, the Leylines. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is an artist whose work is inspired by nature and mans many links with our natural environment. Zach Greening has lived in Somerset for the last 14 years, and during that time he's continued to create works that communicate themes of sustainability and biodiversity. Zach has been commissioned by corporate clients and had solo exhibitions around the world, and this year he's bringing his creative vision closer to home as one of the key organisers of the Wincanton Town Festival Market, taking place on the 26th of June. Zach, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me at the gallery. What can you tell me about this beautiful building that you're based in?
Oh, God, where do you start? I mean, the provenance, the history of the building, I think, comes from it was built in the 1700s, 1750, I believe. It's had a colourful history with Italian immigrants who then became rag and bone people, men and women, as well as, so the Caves were the family that bought the place back in the day, in the 1700s, I believe, and then they became an ironmongers, effectively. And they had been doing that, I think, since 1979. And then Mrs. Cave died a couple of years ago, and Clementine, as the DIY ironmongers store, was no more. And her son, Nicholas, offered me the opportunity to have my studio and gallery here. And so we've been in here 2 years now, and we're expanding kind of all the time with artists and activities and different programs.
We're just coming up to Father's Day, and before we started recording, you mentioned the children. What are you expecting from the Greening family this year?
God, I'd love to have a lion. That would be a beautiful thing. I have, my expectations don't extend very far with all things kind of national holidays and celebrations. Christmas in particular, I'm a little bit bar humbug. But Father's Day, yes, it's another day, isn't it? I think actually Father's Day, given what my partner and other mothers do, really, if they have Mother's Day, we should have Father's Hour. Because I look at what Claire, my partner, does, and I just think, I could not do that. That's phenomenal. So I am backup to Claire, basically. She does the kids. I do money, DIY, and make sure she's fed, you know, nutritionally and mentally. And that's my role.
If my research is correct, you've been in Wincanton or the area for about 14 years?
God, yes, 14 years.
But you have a Somerset connection that goes back way before then?
No.
In your school?
Oh, yes. Okay, so correct. I was thinking you were alluding to some distant family member
that you don't know
the
about.
Annals.
And they're here now.
Yes. Yes, I went to school at Millfield. Gosh, I don't know when that was, in the 80s, yeah. But I lived in America at the time, and my dad was British, my mum was American, and dad's job paid for our education over here.
What are your memories of your time at Millfield as a boy?
Pretty good, actually, you know. It's really interesting when you put it in the context of people who haven't been to boarding school, and often the same kind of questions, quizzical questions, come up, like, why would your parents do that? did you suffer mentally as a boy going to boarding school? And I think they have this rather kind of misguided belief that boarding school is rather Dickensian, and that we're all whipped and beaten. And for me, I think I flourished. I loved it. I didn't feel like I was a casualty of it, but yeah, Millfield was great.
What would a typical report card have said about you as a pupil?
So, I would describe myself back then as academically challenged. let's just say that my traditional qualifications of O-levels and A-levels were really not flattering. I did better at university, but no, I crashed and burned academically. I hadn't learned how to learn, I think. That was the thing.
Outside of school, you mentioned living in the States. What did family life look like?
So family life back then, it was fairly feral. I was kind of would wake up, open the door, go out and play in the woods and the streams, listen for mum's bell, and 12, 14 hours later, I'd come back for dinner. So yeah, it was a charmed upbringing, charmed life.
So you were pretty much left to your own devices to explore?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, living in America, my neighborhood was fairly disparate. Dad was working in Washington, D.C. for the World Bank. Mum was looking after us. And, you know, you hung out with all the kids in the neighborhood, and you were on your bikes and in the woods and the streams. And, you know, so yeah, I don't have any complaints.
What were some of your first experiences of the creative arts? Were you taken to galleries and museums by your parents?
No. I didn't have any formal education in art. I had to do all the traditional topics like physics and chemistry and, you know, and always crashed and burned academically in those. So it wasn't until I left university that I got into the arts. And I think there's always been a creative gene being expressed in our family, but no. And actually, I don't think I really kind of ignited with my sense of creativity until after my dad died, actually. I think that was the catalyst.
Was then that creative outlet a way for you to maybe go through the grieving process?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, my degree was in... So my dad worked for the World Bank. He had a very agricultural extension background, working in West Africa. And then he was hired for the World Bank in Washington. And seeing that life that he had seemed really quite glamorous. There was lots of sort of foreign travel. He would come back and we would have a sort of slideshow, and you would see where Dad had been in Syria and West Africa. And you thought, great, that's what I want to do. So academically, my training, my education was geared towards agricultural extension. So my degree was agricultural economics. And then after my degree, I was looking for a job in that field. And that led, I had a job lined up in Tanzania to be a farm manager on an essential oils project. And was really quite pumped about going to live that career life. Then that job fell through, and in the interim, it was suggested to me that I go and get further qualifications to do a master's in agricultural economics. And I had a place down at Y College, had 9 months to kill before that started. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do for 9 months? And in that time, I had a girlfriend whose birthday it was, and I made a wall hanging. It was quite well received, and I thought, well, I'll just do this for 9 months. And that was it. It took hold right then and there. And I thought, this is what I want to do for a living. And then you're faced with a really kind of tough decision of, not a decision, but you You've got to figure out how you're going to do it. You haven't been to art school. You don't have any art qualifications. How are you going to make a living? And that was really the genesis of my career.
To what extent, following the loss of your father then, was there an element of catharsis to some of that early
work? I think, you know, the thing is that if you've experienced, I guess, any sort of death, I was 23 when my dad died. And what it did was kind of made me reevaluate pretty much every facet of my life. You know, there's a kind of, the artistic process has a meditative quality to it. And that meditation kind of gets extended into grieving. And that was quite good for me. Had he been alive, I don't know if I would have become an artist, you know. So in many ways, you don't really know it at the time, but it was a blessing in disguise that he died from that career perspective.
What do you think he would make of your art?
I think Dad would have probably just been happy that you're following your bliss. You know what I mean? So as Dad was into agricultural extension, I think he would have been, and as a kind of supporter of the environmental movement, and given that the narrative of my work has such a strong environmental narrative, I think, yeah, he would have probably gone, well done. Very simply put.
You mentioned, obviously, in your art, you do take a lot of inspiration from nature and the natural world. You spent some time living abroad and working for the likes of Greenpeace. How did that affect your interpretation of that relationship between people and the world in which we live?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that's a question. It depends what day you get me on. You know what? I mean, when I was working at Greenpeace, I really loved the social interaction of that. I understood America way better as a result of that. And when you meet everybody from a kind of Wall Street banker through to a fisherman, you get a real kind of cross-sectional, you understand the American political process. You understand its kind of helplessness that exists because of often a geographical issue between. So I worked in Washington State, in Seattle, and Washington, D.C., obviously the home of politics, 2,500 miles away. It led to people kind of having an apathy not an apathy necessarily, but unable to do anything about it. So that was the one thing that I took away from it. The other great thing about that job was that I used to come across amazing pieces of work, artwork, and I might be on the front door talking about some incinerator, and the next minute I'd see a Giacometti, and that's all I wanted to talk about. So it was an amazing job. I learned so much about myself and about America, and I hadn't really kind of been turned on to art at that point, but it was a different kind of education, really.
Initially then, in your artistic journey, did you think about the message that you wanted to communicate? You mentioned your narrative and being, you know, very tuned into the environment. Was that one of the first messages that you wanted to portray, or were you just trying out new ideas?
Yeah, you know, I think that when you start off as being an artist, often what you're creating is an abstracted or glorified self-portrait. And particularly at that period of in time, I was still grieving for my father. So it was the work I was making then was very much about me. And although you're not really conscious of it, it's kind of comes out. And then you start to see a pattern. The form was usually about the sun, the moon, waves, oceans. I was kind of broke at the time, so I wasn't able to afford expensive materials, and therefore I was making works out of things like paper and found materials. And then, of course, you get a little bit bored of that and you kind of, you start exploring what actually it means to be making a great piece of work. And the great piece of work, I believe, should have kind of narrative, craft, and aesthetic. And so you do graduate kind of emotionally and academically into the work that you're making. So the work I make now is very much trying to hit those three elements. And obviously my time at Greenpeace really kind of highlighted to me, I'd always enjoyed that work, was very passionate about it. Kind of jumping forward a little bit, I was very much in the art world, the gallery scene, and found it very vacuous, if truth be told. I was really starting to resent the fact that I was becoming a glorified statue on a mantelpiece for those people that could afford it. So I achieved what I wanted to achieve in that industry, in that sector, and then moved on very quickly into kind of much more of an environmental campaigning awareness narrative with my work.
One observation about your work is that you don't stick to one particular medium. You frequently use things like light, recycled plastics. I've even seen some of your work with leaves and branches.
Mm.
You talked about early in your career that being out of necessity, but since then, has that become more of a conscious choice?
Oh yeah, God, definitely. I think it's, you know, one of the things I still do to some degree, is on Fridays I would go and rummage through people's recycling bins to find clear plastic bottles. And now I think I am really keen. And in that process, you used to see just what people were throwing away, and you'd be kind of shocked that this amazing material that we deem as kind of rubbish is being discarded so quickly. And then I had a seminal experience when I went over to Castle Carey Dump and I saw the mountains of rubbish. And I just thought, this is obscene. Something's got to be done with that. And, you know, just a simple plastic bottle actually is an amazing material. If you understand its history, what it's made from, how it gets to you, what it does, adds life, literally adds years to your life, and then you throw it away. I mean, that's a crime, really.
So you talked about your time in the art world. During that period, you had exhibitions in New York, London, South Africa. Before that became something that you did not want to be a part of, what were the memorable highlights of that period for you?
Oh, you know, they were all ego-based. And I'm not averse to kind of egotistically driven outcomes. But so, you know, I didn't do too badly. I guess some of the highlights in terms of my CV were commissions with some blue chip companies like Speedo and BP. Having a solo show in the West End, St. James. You know, those were some highlights. I think I very quickly realized I kind of reached a juncture where I went, okay, I can carry on and I can end up with the rather sort of typical successes of being in the Tate Modern or what I would describe as a Premier League artist. And I thought, that's not what I want to do. So I scratched the itch, really, and, you know, doing the corporate thing. I was working a lot with ad agencies, you know, trying to create brand identity installations, things like that. So it gave me a really good grounding and an understanding for the corporate world. Gave me an understanding of kind of how consumerism operates, you know, and all those things. Although you had some failures in it and you were kind of gutted by the failures, you know, with hindsight, you were really grateful for that, for those perceived failures, because now you are where you are.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent, with tracks from local acts in each podcast.
The Ley Lines are a multi-instrumental five-piece whose influences and styles combine folk, indie, punk and festival rock. The band are Steve, Hannah, Dan, Sean and Dave. With a loyal and growing fanbase, the group have recorded two studio albums and played at Glastonbury, the Godney Gathering and Beautiful Days festivals. From their 2019 album, Recover Reveal, this is Control.
While you were living in London, you were with your partner, Claire.
Mm-hmm.
How did the two of you meet?
Jeez. We met at a party in Holloway, not the prison. yeah, so wasn't the best boyfriend. Was ambivalent about relationships, I think. But she pursued, kept going, and eventually I succumbed. And so Claire was in, she was an editor for a science journal. And in many ways, I wish I had that time back again, because she was often meeting really interesting people at the forefront of their careers in science. Whereas I was hanging out with the druggy, arty, stoner types. And I think that was a bit of a waste of time. Whereas now you see, you know, Claire was dealing with Nobel Prize winning, and you think, you know, they should be coming over for dinner. And you'd love to talk to them now with those sorts of interests. That's the only thing I wish I could turn the clock back on, really.
When did you start thinking about leaving the city, and how did you end up here?
So I had quite a big commission with BP, and that was quite financially rewarding. And I thought that I wanted to kind of set up a sculpture park come retreat in South Africa. And I had got introduced to South Africa because I'd been on a TV program called A Place in the Sun, and I really liked it. And so I went back after that, and then after the BP and Speedo commissions, I had a big chunk of money, and I thought, well, I'll go over there and I will see if it's a place that could, if the business model was sustainable over there. So we went and lived there for a season, well, 9 months. And very quickly kind of realized that the business model wasn't going to be sustainable. Then Claire got pregnant with my eldest, and just knew that she wouldn't want to raise a family in South Africa. And so we came back and started looking around four counties, really, kind of Dorset, Wiltshire, Devon, and we just thought, well, okay, my sister's nearby, my mum's in Sherborne, Wincanton looks like a good, practical, affordable place to live. And we saw the house and bought that, and yeah, that was the beginning of the Wincanton chapter.
How would you describe the effect that the local area has had on your work?
God, that's a question, isn't it? I don't know if it's affected me that much. I think, you know, Britain has got what I would describe as a very kind of manicured, slightly sanitized geographical aesthetic that looks great on a postcard in terms of kind of nature's energy. I think it works on a very low vibration. Does it inspire my work? Not really. I think the thing is that as an artist, you're a voyeur and you're sort of outwardly looking the whole time. So I tend to look at the global rather than the micro. Mm. But actually, interestingly, I am kind of revising that because I know that I can't change the world. I can only change my immediate environment. And of course, I can change that. And so Wincanton, you know, that's probably where you have to make the difference.
Have you found the local community to be engaged with your work and the subjects that it covers?
Yeah, I think they do. I think, you know, art in Wincanton is kind of, it's almost a byproduct of a failed system. I think this might be a contentious response, but I go into schools a lot and I do kind of workshops about upcycling, reuse, environmental narratives. And what is kind of painfully aware is the lack of art in our education, in our curriculum. It's kind of, it's really seen as this luxury item, and really it's far from it. So when I get a lot of kids coming, or I go into the, often they've never even been into an art gallery. So for them to come in, you know, there's an ignition that happens, and generally speaking, I don't have anybody that doesn't like the work, and if they do, thankfully they keep it to themselves. So yeah.
One of the things that you have on your side here, I suppose, is that the space doesn't look like a traditional art gallery, and maybe when people think about an art gallery, they have something which is a little bit more staid in their minds.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, one of the things I'm really keen to pursue is that art is for everybody. It's a universal language. And all too often, art has been shoehorned into or has associations with elitism and privilege. And I don't believe that should be the case, that actually, like I said, it is the universal language and it should be open to all. And to break down those rather kind of preconceived ideas of what art is, and it's not a commodity for sale necessarily. And so we have a very kind of open door policy. And I don't want to be your stereotypical gallery at all. There's enough places out there who, frankly, would do it better than me. So, you know, I'm really keen to kind of open the doors and let people who wouldn't otherwise be exposed to the arts to see kind of the essence of it and hopefully connect with it, really.
In the time that you've been here, how have you seen the broader Somerset art world evolve and change?
I would say I haven't, because I've not really been looking. I am really keen to collaborate with other artists, I think. And so I have been kind of actively seeking them out. And I'm really pleasantly surprised and discovering a lot of creative talent. And a lot of it kind of untapped. So this place, you know, what we're trying to do here is to kind of catalyze that creativity and to make it more outward facing. So a lot of the artists that are taking studios here, one of the requirements is that they take their creative artistic practice and apply it out into the community. Still very early days, but you know, that's showing quite good returns, really, both kind of, well, mainly culturally, I think, and in terms of community.
Let's talk about the Wincanton Town Festival.
Ah, yes.
The WTF event. Mm-hmm. This is something that's taking place at the second time of asking, isn't it?
Yeah, so the first one was WTF in 2016, and that was basically turning the whole high street into an art gallery, I guess. So we had, back then, God, was it 25 shops, 40 artists, 40 bits of work. It was all about kind of promoting Wincanton as a destination to show the Wincanton experience, but utilizing the arts as that vehicle for that experience. And then I decided that Wincanton Town Festival Market was something that I wanted to do. So I've been collaborating with Claudia Cole from across the road, a local businesswoman, and we've been organizing an art market experience. So we've got 25 artists, stall holders, all coming on the 26th to either display or demonstrate their creativity and their wares. We've got some food, and we've got musicians and performers. And the idea really is to kind of promote the idea of community and ecological sustainability, but using again the arts as that vehicle for communication.
So do you have to be artistic to get involved?
As a stall holder, yes, preferably. As somebody that is more inquisitive or just likes the arts and wants to turn up and enjoy the gardens and the ambience and the experience, then you don't have to be anything other than that.
Is this something that's primarily aimed at the younger generation, or are you looking to provide a bit of everything for all ages?
Yeah, I think we're trying to provide everything for all ages. I think there's going to be something for everybody here. But, you know, again, it's kind of going back to what I was saying about the arts being a universal appreciation. So, you know, if you're into the botany of plants, or you're into the arts and you're into food, then this is the event that will tick all those boxes, I think.
And on the food side, you've got everything from growing to cooking to eating.
No, we've got people who are doing kind of foraging courses. We've got forest school. Our coffee people are making coffee powered by solar panels. There's, what else have we got? We've got more sort of permaculture, no dig activities going on. So yeah, I think it promises to be quite a colourful event.
After the last, you know, 12 months, longer than 12 months that we've had, How important is it to the town to gather around something like this?
I think everybody's desperate to get back to some degree of normality, aren't they? I have sort of mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I'd like to see this event being, you know, that sort of initial return to, in inverted commas, normality. I don't think we'll go into the more negative observations of what coronavirus has done to our society and that sort of thing. But I think that everyone will really welcome having a good time, won't they?
The environmental angle that is permeating the market this year is something which in my time in Wincanton, I think, was very much bubbling up and becoming, you know, more of a movement. As someone who's lived here for a little bit longer than that, how have you seen the ethos and the values of the town change?
That question is part of a larger, broader question, which is this sort of, it's more about our addiction to consumption. And, you know, I saw it in my Greenpeace days that actually everybody's very concerned about the environment and they want to do something about it. Often they don't know what to do, what can they do. But also I think it's really about kind of identifying the fact that we are all addicted to consumption. So, you know, with the best will in the world, myself included, I find giving up those things that I need to give up to save the planet really painful. You know, for me, it's avocados. You know, the carbon footprint of those things is criminal. But, you know, I can reduce my consumption, but I can't get rid of the cravings and the urges. And that's what's really key, I think, it's that addiction. How do you give up your addiction? And unless somebody tells you to give it up, I don't think it's that easy to voluntarily give it up to save, you know, the environment. And if you're told, and it's a failing of kind of the political system too, because if somebody's telling you, you've got to give up flying, you've got to give up eating less meat, and now I'm going to ask you to vote for me, I don't think you're going to do it, are you? Because it's too much pain. And that's part of the problem, isn't it? So, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I would love to think that one could voluntarily save the planet. And that's where the political element has to come in. And that's the thing that one of the proponents of components of what we do here is that political lobbying element. So we did an installation down at the Blue School called Save Our Seas, Message in a Bottle. And we made a large kind of mural that went across the school and it was all lit up. But the political element came by the younger kids writing making a mosaic of a fish. But on the back, they wrote these letters to MPs that had constituencies asking for more marine protected areas. So, you know, that's a really nice kind of fusion between art and campaigning, which isn't directly answering your question, but it led quite nicely onto that.
So, what is next for you? What's on your radar?
God, you know what? I would die a happy man if I made an art piece that was responsible for changing policy, governmental policy. Increasingly, I'm really keen to collaborate with people like Greenpeace, Surfers Against Sewage. You know, the list is endless, to kind of make politically motivated installations, art pieces that furthered that objective. So, that's, I guess, what I'm working towards.
Before we wrap up, where can people find out more about you and about the festival market?
So go to www.zackgreen.com. Sounds weird just saying that. So yeah, my website, you can see more of my work there. In terms of the WTF market, that's on most of the social media, hashtags in Canton Town Festival Market. Yeah, you'll find us there.
Zach, thank you so...
That was foreboding. That was almost a sign, wasn't it? Yes.
Oh dear. Zach, thank you so much for your time. You've been a fantastic guest. It's been a delight talking to you.
No, thanks very much. Pleasure meeting you too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.